Welcome to the Fulham on the Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy, recording at 8:53 Greenwich Mean Time. Today is January 25th. Today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio for the various different asset classes. And this has been a significant week in terms of what's happened in a range of asset classes. If we start with currencies, because it's perhaps one of the more important themes in what's been happening over the last 6 weeks. And the yen has extended its decline, and it's closing out the week at 90.89. It was as low today as 91.19, and that's against the US dollar. The Japanese have decided to weaken their currency on a unilateral basis, and currency movements, particularly over and during the credit crisis, weren't generally unilateral. There was quite a bit of multilateral intervention in terms of the synchronizing of quantitative easing among various different economies and cutting interest rates on a concerted basis, and certainly some currencies fell more than others. But with the yen, we're seeing that what had previously been perhaps the strongest currency in the world, and one that had had one of the more consistent uptrends against the US dollar over the last 3 or 4 years, that uptrend has been broken. The US dollar is in a new uptrend against the yen, and that opens up a whole range of possibilities. And the most obvious has been that the Japanese stock market, which has been moribund for a number of years, has responded to a catalyst which is aimed primarily at not only combating the deflationary spiral that the economy has been in, but also to spur demand for Japanese goods abroad with a weaker currency. And some of the better share performance has been among that export-led sector. But the export-led sector and the export-led growth model isn't something that's particular to Japan. And while China is currently doing its best to develop a consumer leg to its growth model, which has until recently really been focused on infrastructure development and exports, that export sector is still very considerable. And of course, the rest of Asia has the whole tiger economies were based on export-led growth. And that presents a really quite an interesting problem for some of these countries, because if the Japanese are devaluing their currency, and some people have put a target of 95 to the dollar, and this is before the new central bank governor is ever even appointed, and that won't happen until April. But who's to say that the currency won't weaken even more than 95? And when you look at the consistency of the dollar's decline against the yen over the last decade, then this is a very powerful break in that downtrend. And it does look like the dollar is going to get stronger against the yen, and not just over this short term, but potentially over the medium term. And by medium term, we could be talking about anything from a few months to a number of years, when we see such an emphatic break of what had previously been a consistent decline. So putting a value on to what extent the yen will devalue is, or a target on it, is pretty futile at this stage, I suspect. And these export-led growth markets in Asia, are they willing to sit quietly by and allow their competitiveness relative to Japanese exports to be eroded, and eroded relatively quickly given the speed with which the yen is deteriorating? And the answer, if this week's price action is anything to go by, is no. they're not willing to sit on the sidelines and let their competitiveness be eroded. And we saw a downward dynamic this week, and particularly today, for the Asian dollar index. And the Korean won in particular is a 14% weighting on that index. And it has had such a consistent advance against the dollar since June, and it's just been falling practically on consecutive, the dollar has been falling practically on consecutive weeks. And this week the dollar rallied and broke that progression of lower rally highs. When Samsung today announced that it was going to take a $2.8 billion loss because of the strength of the yuan against the Brazilian real and the Chinese yuan, then we can anticipate that the Korean government is going to do something, and the Korean central bank is going to do something to weaken the currency. And the Singapore dollar, which has been a tower of strength, has also weakened in here. And the Thai baht, which has been among the stronger currencies over the last 3 and 4 weeks, and it has been appreciating rather abruptly, also encountered resistance in here this week. And the question then is, are they going to depreciate further? And as long as the Japanese are continuing to aggressively weaken their currency, then we can anticipate that the response from other Asian governments and other Asian central banks is likely to be increasingly more aggressive. And there is a real possibility that we could have competitive devaluation, which isn't something that we've really had since the credit crisis, because central banks have generally been acting in concert. And this opens a Pandora's box, because we have been presented with quantitative easing, and quantitative easing with regard to the USA and the UK and Europe has been relatively measured. And more or less, the euro and the dollar and the pound have been reasonably volatile, but have been more or less locked in a range over the last 3 and 4 years. But the Japanese currency has appreciated, and the Chinese currency has appreciated, and Asian currencies have appreciated over that time frame. And Japan has obviously said that enough is enough. The Finnish finance minister already today was saying that the euro is too strong at $1.3460. And that's following a rally of about 15 cents. Over the last few months, but it's still very much within the range that has been developing, albeit with a downward bias, over the last 3 years. And today was also interesting because the ECB announced that it was expecting a number of 3-year loans that had been extended to the banking sector to be repaid early, and that decreases the risk that the ECB will need to engage in additional quantitative easing. Now, obviously, there are still some substantial problems out there in the Eurozone, particularly on the periphery, and the ability of some of these highly indebted countries to repay those debts remains very much an open question. And the chances are that this European problem isn't going to be eventually solved until we get some form of debt forgiveness, and not least a growth strategy. But in the short term, these banks continue to rally, and the banking sector has returned to a position of outperformance in Europe. And I've done an extensive review of relative charts for banking sectors in Comment of the Day today. And perhaps the most important aspect is that regardless of which geographic region you're talking about, banks are either performing in line or outperforming their respective markets. And from our perspective, that's a tailwind for risk assets. Bull markets thrive on liquidity. Banks are liquidity providers. Banks should do well in an environment where there is abundant liquidity. And with Japanese actions and Chinese actions to spur its economy and open-ended quantitative easing from the USA, and the potential that the Bank of England is going to step in and start to add more money following the risk that there's going to be a triple dip recession. Then we're presented with an environment where not only is there abundant liquidity, but that liquidity could become even more abundant. And if we are in a possible situation where we could have a competitive devaluation of currencies, then that turns into a very interesting situation for risk assets generally and safe haven type assets in particular, and particularly those types of assets that can simply be printed into existence. Now, gold this week has fallen by about $40, having tested the $1,700 area, and it's been lagging the other precious metals. Silver, which had been up on consecutive days, has been pulling back over the last 3 days and was down by an additional 50 cents in here today. But so far, and while this pullback hasn't ended yet, and we'll need an upward dynamic to really suggest that it has, this could still be considered a consolidation of recent gains. And both platinum and palladium have been the clear leaders in the precious metals sector. And platinum was stronger today by $12, and palladium by $14, and pushing right up to $740 and continuing to lead to the upside. And when we look at these types of assets and the threat of competitive devaluation, then gold is something that can hold its value over the long term. So while there are risks in the short term, and while we remain within this volatile ranging environment, the medium term outlook for gold remains positive, not least because other precious metals are leading to the upside, and that has generally been a formula for gold to play catch up in the not too distant future. Gold has been prone to 18-month consolidations, and we're coming to the end of the most recent of those. And if we're correct that gold is in the accumulation phase of this consolidation, then we'll see it pushing back above $1,700 and back above $1,800 and pushing onto new high ground at some point this year. When we look at stock markets, we've had a remarkably good rally for the majority of these markets over the course of January, and it's very much a liquidity-fueled advance. Primarily, we've seen Wall Street leading to the upside, and the S&P is currently sitting at 1,500 points. It has paused in this region for the last couple of days, but considering the extent to which liquidity continues to flow into this market, then this is creating the opportunity for carry trades to evolve once more. And if we think about what were the conditions for carry trades to work back before the credit crisis, it was to have a weak currency and a low interest rate and abundant assets in which to invest that cheaply borrowed cash. Well, the yen is certainly weak, and interest rates are at zero, and stock markets continue to trend higher. So that's a perfect situation from a speculative perspective. The CAC and the DAX in Europe spent the last 2 weeks going pretty much sideways, and they broke out of those ranges in here today. So this short-term rally that has been evident in stock markets over the last month remains intact. Now, if we take a step back and we look at the long term, then this is an interesting scenario, because we look at the FTSE and it's broken out of a 2-year range, it's continuing to extend its advance, and it's pushing up to the upper side of a 10-year range, and in some cases 12 and 13-year ranges. And the S&P pushing through 1,500 points is putting it within striking distance of the upper side of its range, which has been evident over the last decade. And the DAX is closing in on the 8,000 level, which isn't so far away from the upper side of its 12-year range. And we've characterized this long-ranging phase as a generational-long process of P/E ratio contraction and rising dividend yields. And when one looks at those yield charts in particular, and we see what has been done in terms of quantitative easing, then more than half of the shares on the S&P 500 yield more than 10-year treasuries. And that's a situation which hasn't really been evident since the late 1950s. And before that, it was considered that equities had to yield more than bonds to compensate investors for the risk that they were taking on in buying these securities. But we're in a situation today where companies are generally well capitalized, and those that are leveraged to the growth of the global consumer have tended to do extraordinarily well. And an increasing number have grown beyond their own borders, and they're no longer tied to their domestic economies, and they've become truly global operations. And those that really dominate their respective niches and have generally solid records of increasing their dividends, we classify as autonomies. And this remains a very powerful theme, because we remain within probably the greatest era of humanism there is ever likely to be. And the global population is likely to expand by an additional 2 billion people in the next 20 years. And in that time frame, global growth is expanding even faster, and it's swelling the ranks of the middle classes. And we've added 1 billion new consumers to the global economy in the last decade, and we'll probably add another 1 billion in the next decade. And that means that demand for just about everything is likely to increase. When we look at where markets have been, and you look at companies where prices are now breaking out, but their P/E ratios are still, in some cases, 30 and 40% below where their P/Es were back in 2000, it suggests that before we ever get anywhere close to those valuations, prices could be substantially higher than they are now. And if we look at how the last generational-long process of P/E ratio contraction and rising dividend yields ended, and that was back in the early 80s, in nominal terms, prices for the S&P broke out and then started to pull back, and valuations bottomed when prices were actually starting to retest to the previous peak. We saw valuations get reasonably low in 2008, and certainly we've had some valuation expansion over the last few years, but we're certainly not in bubble territory. And yes, there has been a great deal of interest in the high-yielding sector, but high yield hasn't really been our focus. What we've been looking for is dividend growth, and more importantly, reliability of the dividend. And it gives us an indication of the health of the balance sheet. And when we see a global company, that's really more important to us. But what's, of course, the great arbiter is price. And when we see that markets are breaking out of decade-long ranges, that's important. And in terms of price action and the type of analysis that we do, it's the holy grail. Because when we see a base formation completion, such as we've seen in the consumer sector over the last 2 years, and we're now seeing in the industrial sector, then we get really excited. We're in a fantastically exciting period of history, where technological advancement is accelerating at a prodigious rate. And we've seen a true evolution in the energy complex, so that natural gas production has expanded rapidly, and unconventional oil production is expanding just as rapidly. And this is so far really just a US story, but there is infinite possibilities for this story to become a global story. So, yes, oil prices are still high, and in the very short term, there's still a risk that they might go a little bit higher. But the hysteria about spikes in the oil price has probably been overdone. And over the next decade, we can anticipate that energy prices will go lower in real terms. And because of inflationary pressures, we've seen that the Chinese labor cost has increased steadily. And the last administration's Wen Jiabao said that he wanted to eliminate poverty by 2020. And they intend to raise the minimum wage every year for the next decade. So the competitive advantage in terms of labor costs that was really a hallmark of Asia and China's development isn't such a large factor for China anymore. And labor costs, because of the recession in the USA, have contracted. And energy prices in the USA are at a considerable discount to just about everywhere else. And the stock market has been going sideways for 12 years, and we're into our 13th year. And valuations are certainly not at bargain levels, but neither are they at bubble levels. And we're presented with abundant liquidity. Now, in here today, with the ECB announcing that the loans that it extended to the banking sector are likely to be paid back early, it's had a negative effect on government bonds. And if we look at the various asset classes out there, then equities have been largely unloved over the last 13 years, and participation in the equity markets has deteriorated, and much of that money has flown into bonds because of the promise of low volatility and a government-sponsored bull market. But that government-sponsored bull market is dependent on economic news deteriorating further. And if we start to see that some of the news turns positive, then the necessity for quantitative easing is removed. And that would suggest that there could be a normalization of interest rates. And the Fed's hawkish tone at its most recent meeting suggests that the Fed is beginning to look at perhaps a more benign scenario in terms of the economy. And if the ECB is thinking that the banking sector can pay back its loans a bit earlier, then that results in a more benign attitude towards Europe. So today, US Treasuries were weaker by almost 2 full points, and Eurobonds were weaker by 0.7 of a point. Gilts were weaker by about 0.4 of a point. And while the futures are interesting, the yields are perhaps even more interesting, because the US 10-year yield found support in the region of 1.8% 3 days ago, and it has bounced emphatically. And that 1.8% represented the upper side of the underlying trading range, and it's back above the 200-day moving average. And Eurobonds, while still within their range and within this base formation, are back above their 200-day moving average. And the Swiss 10-year has extended its advance. The yield bottomed in December and formed a large upside key reversal, and it's continued to extend the advance. And this suggests that we have hit at least short-term and potentially medium-term lows in the yield, which suggests that demand for bonds is deteriorating. And if we are presented with a more benign economic scenario in the USA and Europe, that would suggest that interest rates can rise from here. So at present, we're presented with a liquidity-fueled environment. And as long as that remains the case, we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. But at the same time, we can probably anticipate that the bulk of new liquidity likely to fuel this market is going to come from Asia, and that the need for liquidity infusions in Europe is probably, and in the USA, is likely to deteriorate. And that also suggests that scope for additional strength by the euro and the dollar is probably a bit more than people anticipate. Over the last decade, a lot of investors have been investing in Asia, not least because it's the growth center of the global economy, but also because of the strength of the respective currencies. So you were getting a double advantage, because not only were you buying into an appreciating stock market, but also you were buying a currency which was appreciating against your domestic currency. Well, the stock markets are probably still going to continue to advance in a liquidity-fueled environment, but if we see increased volatility in the currency returns, then we're into a situation where stock market investments from a foreign investor's perspective could become a bit more volatile. Whereas if the euro and the dollar become a bit firmer, then returns from those stock markets could become a bit less volatile. And therefore, it is notable that we're seeing such strong action from some of those markets, and particularly in view of the fact that they're approaching the upper side of what have been decade-long ranges. And I think with that, I will leave you for the evening, and I wish all the best to all of you.